how the forces that gave rise to World War I are once again shaping the world today. Next week marks the centennial of the United States' entry into World War I. Over 35,000 Mainers, including two governors, served over there, and more than 1,000 were killed. But perhaps because of the passing of time or the impact of World War II, the First World War seems in many ways to have been overshadowed in history. Yet, it had a profound effect on the U.S. and the world. Today, we're going to discuss how Maine communities, large and small, were affected by the war and the parallels between current events and the economic and political forces at the time of World War I. And, of course, we want to hear from you. Do you have a family story about a relative who fought in the Great War? Maine Calling is next. First, this news update. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Keith Shortall, and this is Maine Calling. April 6 marks the centennial of the United States' entry into World War I. 100 years ago, it was called the War to End All Wars. It, of course, did not do that. The passing of time and the impact of the Second World War that followed has, in many ways, overshadowed the First World War. But the impact of that is still felt today. In the studio with me to talk about Maine's role in the Great War, Jamie Kingman Rice. She's Director of Library Services for the Maine Historical Society. Currently on display at the Maine Historical Society is an exhibit called World War I and the Maine Experience. Jonathan Bratton is historian for the Maine National Guard, and Richard Rubin is the author of two books about World War I, The Last of the Doughboys, and Back Over There, One American Time Traveler, 100 years Since the Great War, 500 miles of battle-scarred French countryside, and Too Many Trenches, Shells, and Legends, and Ghosts to Count. Back Over There comes out in April. Welcome, first to all of you, first of all.
Thank you.
And as well, of course, we want to hear from you as well. How much do you know about the war to end all wars, and do you have maybe a family story? Our phone number is 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. If we all agree that World War I maybe has not been granted the same importance or presence in history, or maybe it was just been shoved further to the back behind World War II, or maybe it's the passage of time. Richard Rubin, why do you think that's happened?
Well, I think there are several factors. First, it's important to know that once upon a time, Americans, North and South, East and West, considered the First World War to be tremendously important in this country. And the only thing, the only proof you need of that is the fact that anywhere you go in this country, no matter how small the town is or whatever else they may or may not have, they will have a World War I memorial. I've been to towns that have nothing to the Civil War or World War II, and they still have something to World War I. So once upon a time, this country considered it tremendously important, not only that we remember it, but that we recognize the role that the First World War played in making the United States of America what it is today, the country we live in. But there are a few factors, I think, that sort of shifted that more to the background. The first is that it was a very traumatic experience for this country. We were only actually in the fight itself for about a year. We joined the war. We entered the war on April 6, 1917, but the first three deaths in the American Expeditionary Forces were November 3, 1917. So you've basically got 12 months. And in those 12 months, more than 116,000 Americans died over there. This stood in very sharp relief against the previous experience of a war, the Spanish-American War, which was kind of a romp in comparison. It was over very quickly, relatively few American casualties. And afterwards, I think a lot of Americans started thinking about what did those men die for? And as years passed, that answer became less and less clear. You know, ostensibly, they died, quote, to make the world safe for democracy. But as time went on through the 20s and then the 30s, it became increasingly apparent that the world was not, in fact, safe for democracy. So what did they die for? It became increasingly traumatic, I think. Americans withdrew into ourselves. We became more isolationist. Add on top of that the Great Depression, hard times. And I think that Americans just didn't really want to think about it after a certain point. And then you've got World War II that comes along, a very telegenic war. You've got sound films now, whereas during the First World War, you only had silent films. You've got movie-caliber villains in World War II. I mean, you had the Kaiser in World War I, but he was nothing compared to the gang that we were up against then. And I think that just sort of furthered the process. Americans, because we didn't think that much about World War I, I don't think we reflected all that much on the tremendously important role that we played in changing the course of that war and the outcome.
I've heard you talk also about this fact that this generation that went to that war, that by its character, it wasn't a generation to dwell on this. It was also a generation that suffered hardships, that where family members died early, and so they didn't really want to dwell on this. They wanted to move forward.
Well, that's right. Everybody I interviewed, with one exception for the last of the Doughboys, and I interviewed several dozen men and women who had participated in the war in one way or other, were very, very stoic. And honestly, I don't know if that was a characteristic of that generation or just the people I met, but I'm inclined to believe the former. Because if you know anything about life in this country around the turn of the century, it was very hard. Infant mortality rates were much higher than they are now. A shocking number of the people I interviewed lost at least one parent during their childhood. And they didn't know any different. Everybody had it hard, and they didn't think they had it particularly hard, even with the horrors they saw over there. So they were really disinclined to dwell on it.
They kind of shrugged off the experience of being gassed. It's just...
one of the first veterans I interviewed, J. Lawrence Moffat, who was in the Yankee Division from New England, I asked him at one point, "Did you ever get gassed?" And he said, "Oh, yes, all the time." And I said, "What was that like?" And he just shrugged and he said, "I just lost my voice for a few days and it came back. I didn't go to medical for it." And I defy you to find a single description of the effects of poison gas in World War I in a book that says laryngitis was the worst of the problem.
Jonathan Bratton, let's talk about the Yankee Division. This was a group of National Guard forces from New England. What was interesting or unusual about them?
Yeah, so the... you have to remember, we're used to these days having a massive federal force, a regular Army, Navy, Marine Corps, Air Force. At the time that the U.S. entered World War I, the regular forces for the Army were around 150,000 troops. When you're talking the Germans and the French fielding millions overseas. So they needed to get up to strength, and they needed to get the U.S. Army up to strength quickly. So the way to do this is you tap the National Guard, and this is the first time that the National Guard gets mobilized in a wartime experience in its entire creation. Prior to, it had been just call up of U.S. volunteers. Now they were called up as a full entity, and to do that, they formed them into divisions. So the first National Guard division that was formed was the 26th Division, out of all New England troops. And so we're talking the headquarters out of Massachusetts and then regiments from Massachusetts, Connecticut, Rhode Island, Vermont, New Hampshire, Maine, going to be sent overseas to – well, they didn't know what they were going to do yet.
They didn't have proper orders to go.
No. In fact, they were called up. They did some guard duty because in 1917, you have to understand, in 1917, everybody in New England, especially Maine, were seeing U-boats everywhere, and there were Zeppelins all over the place. So these were the reports that kept coming into all the newspapers and everyone saying, "Oh, my neighbor saw a U-boat." So the guard was sent out to patrol along the coast and to guard railroad bridges against all these spies and saboteurs that were supposedly swarming the New England coast. And then they're sent to their mobilization camps down in Massachusetts in August of 17. And suddenly, you know, within about a month, they are shipped off overseas. And they're done so because of the actions of Major General Clarence Edwards, who I like to say is the best person who could have commanded the Yankee Division, because he was an Ohioan by birth and then moved to New England. And I'm an Ohioan by birth and I moved to New England. So,
but you're not a bristly character like him.
No, no. I like to think I'm not as abrasive. He decided that he wanted to get his division first to France to beat everybody else. Already the U.S. 1st Regular Division was there, but the next division to cross was supposed to be the 42nd Division, the Rainbow Division. General MacArthur was in that, Douglas. And he decided that he was not going to abide by the current timetable of troop crossings, and so he went and finagled his way onto any troops that he could, stole the 42nd Division's transports, and as the last ship in the convoy left Halifax, he sent a notice back to the War Department that the 26th Division was on its way to France.
General Edwards was a young officer in 1898. Awaiting orders in Texas with his unit to ship out for Cuba when the Spanish-American War ended. And apparently he didn't want to miss another war.
He was into it.
Yeah.
Jamie Kingman Rice, a lot of interesting stories and anecdotes, particularly around Maine, as we were just hearing. But what was the attraction to this period in history that prompted you to – was it just the 100th anniversary? And explain kind of what it is that you're in this exhibit. You're trying to get people to take away.
Well, the anniversary is certainly a part of the society's interest in commemorating World War I. But Maine Historical Society has been committed to collecting World War I since World War I. And during the war period, the librarians, my predecessors, collected related material extensively, propaganda that was sent throughout the United States as early as 1914. So our collections are very rich with World War I material. And within the last 20 years or so, we've seen an increase, an influx in that material. So we wanted to showcase an opportunity to inform people that we're interested in these stories and that the collective memory is interesting to us, but also to showcase the society's interest in the war early on. I think what we're really trying to showcase is obviously the Maine experience that you would gather from the title, and how the people of Maine experienced the war, how that was the same, how that was different, and to showcase Maine's unique position geographically, our relationship to the Atlantic, our relationship to the European continent, as well as a border state shared with Canada that joined the war immediately with the rest of the Commonwealth. So to showcase those different experiences and how that made us Americans, how that made us people from Maine, and how relevant World War I is to what we hear today in the political rhetoric.
Well, let's stay there then. We talked at the top of the show about the parallels between the economic and political forces at the time of World War I and how they compare to what's happening on the world stage today. Can you talk about those parallels?
I think it ties largely to globalization, or the pushback against globalization. Nationalism certainly is a large aspect of what the rhetoric during World War I, as well as you see today, a push against immigration and the immigrant communities, and what it really means to be an American. We have a poster in the exhibit that asks, are you 100% American? And I think that really sums up, what does it mean to be 100% American? What defines that? And the poster is asking people to prove it by purchasing Liberty Bonds. But essentially, what makes someone an American? What makes someone a patriot? And I think you hear a lot of those same sentiments today, why someone is more American than someone else. And a lot of this is very prevalent during World War I.
And at the time, technology was also driving, I guess, real fears about the globalization of the economy even then?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, technology at the time was essentially newspapers, But there were actually two ways that people back then got their news. One was newspapers, and any city of any size had more than one daily newspaper. So they were in competition with each other, and just more news got out. There was more incentive to sort of rile up your readership and make them believe that only you were giving them the real story. And the other way that people got their news back then was actually by songs. Songs were a real conveyor. You know, there were a lot of people who, for one reason or another, didn't read newspapers. But some of those people went to saloons every day after work. And if you went into a saloon, there would often be a fellow playing the piano in there singing a song that had just been released in sheet music that day. At the time, the center of American music was a stretch of 28th Street in Manhattan called Tin Pan Alley that was full of itinerant songwriters. And what they would do is they would get up in the morning, they would take the train down to 28th Street, they would pick up several newspapers at the nearest newsstand, and then they would go in and they would read what was going on in the world. They would write up a song or two about it by lunchtime, and it would be published and for sale on the street by the end of work that day. And that's how an awful lot of people got their news. That's, in a way, how an awful lot of people took the temperature of the country and the world.
Let's talk about, I guess, how this war started. We all know about the assassination of the Archduke Ferdinand and all of that. But what really sparked it? It was a bit of a barroom brawl that just kind of spread, right?
Yeah. Oh, so that this is the one that will sort of all the historians will argue over, you know, and cause more barroom brawls. It's a sort of what happens when you have what we would sort of call modern treaties tied up with age-old dislikes. The roots of the war were really about 30 years prior in the Franco-Prussian War, where the French and then the Kingdom of Prussia went to war, and the French thought there would be a nice easy victory, and all of a sudden, the Prussians rolled them over in a matter of weeks, causing massive casualties. And so that really rankled the entire French spirit for a very long time. You talk about nationalism and a rise of nationalism. I mean, these guys were it weighed on the national conscience, so to speak. And so as events unrelated sort of sparked off in the Balkans, The gears of war were set in such a way that when one nation would declare war with another, so in the case of Serbia and the Austro-Hungarian Empire, that would set the wheels in motion for another nation to come online. And as soon as Germany got involved, they suddenly realized, well, we're going to end up fighting a war against Russia and France, so we'd better knock out one of them as quickly as possible. And so they invade. They invade neutral Belgium, which of course brings Great Britain into the war. And all of a sudden, in a matter of months, as Barbara Tuchman writes in her great book *Guns of August*, you've got the entire European continent up in arms, and the U.S. is just sitting back, going, "What on earth is happening?"
Yeah, and we'll get to how the U.S. finally decides to go in, because there's an interesting story that may not get much coverage, which we'll talk about. But right now, we'll take a short break. The number to join the conversation is 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Endicott Home in Scarborough, thanking customers with a March event featuring smaller-scale, non-toxic furniture. Condofurniture.com. And The Mooring on Foreside, committed to providing exceptional, personalized memory care in an intimate residential setting. TheMooringOnForeside.com.
On the next Fresh Air, North Korea's nuclear program and the Trump administration's response. We talk with New York Times national security correspondent David Sanger. North Korea recently launched several ballistic missiles and claims that it's preparing to test an intercontinental ballistic missile that could reach the U.S. Join us.
Tune in to Fresh Air tonight at 7 o'clock. Do you love and appreciate public broadcasting? Well, then, lend your voice in support of this valued service. Participate in our I Love Maine Public testimonial campaign, designed to raise awareness of what Maine Public means to Maine and its citizens. You can be a big part of this initiative, and all it takes is a minute of your time. We have an I Love Maine Public hotline, photo opportunities, and a written and verbal testimonial vault. There are any number of fun ways for you to join in. Please go to mainepublic.org to see all the ways you can participate. And thanks.
And welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Keith Shortall. Today on the program, marking the centennial of the First World War. With me in studio, Jonathan Bratton, his historian for the Maine National Guard. Jamie Kingman Rice is director of library services for Maine Historical Society. And Richard Rubin is the author of The Last of the Doughboys and his new book, Back Over There, which will be published April 4th. And we invite you to join the conversation as well. As always, the number 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We know that the U.S. was, as we've said, came into the war quite late. What were the reasons that – what was the tipping point, I guess, that brought them in?
Well, I always take issue with people who use the term late. I always say late for what exactly? I mean, if the United States had entered World War I in August of 1914, none of us may exist. My own grandfather served in the war, and he might not have survived another 2 years and 8 months of it. But, you know, everybody saw what Jonathan eloquently described coming for years and years. The war was no surprise to anybody, especially in the United States. We had a certain perspective on it that Europe didn't. And people here didn't want any part of it. By and large, people came to America to get away from the old world and its entanglements. And we were thrilled, or at least relieved, to be separated from it by an ocean. And a lot of people didn't want to go to war for places that they had essentially fled. But Germany was at a distinct disadvantage in the war in that Britain ruled the seas. And so while the United States was free to sell armaments to anybody, and in fact Britain spent fully half its war budget in the United States, Germany couldn't get anything, and they could only fight back the only way they could, which was through submarine warfare, which was in essence the terrorism of its day. And that did not sit well with the American public when the Lusitania was sunk in 1915 with a loss of 128 American lives. There was a great outcry in this country to do something about it. To his credit, President Wilson said no. We're instead going to make Germany forswear unrestricted submarine warfare. And they did until the beginning of 1917, when Germany was really starting to hurt from the blockade. And at that point, they decided that even though they knew it would bring the United States into the war, they wouldn't be able to win without resuming unrestricted submarine warfare. There's also a very colorful episode known as the Zimmerman Note, a telegram. At the beginning of the war, Great Britain cut the only other existing transatlantic cable from Europe to the United States, which meant that all news of the war had to go through Great Britain. And they intercepted a note from the German government to the German ambassador in Mexico in early 1917 that, again, anticipating that submarine warfare would bring America into the war on the Allies' side, Germany tried to strike up a deal with Mexico saying, make war with us, make peace with us, and after the war is over and we win, we're going to give you back New Mexico, Arizona, Texas, California, etc. Britain held on very cannily, held on to this note until they sensed that war fever was really at a tipping point in this country and then released it.
Yeah. Jamie Kingman Rice, was there war fever here in Maine? Did you get a sense from your research about what the climate was here?
There's an excellent article written in 1938 by a historian named Edwin Costrell, who eventually became a historian for the State Department, and he was a University of Maine graduate, called How Maine Viewed the War. And it's an analysis of the larger papers in Maine between 1914 and the declaration of war in April of 1917. And in many ways, no, there was not, certainly in response to the Lusitania, as Richard mentioned. But in general, Maine was neutral and wanted to remain neutral with these flare-ups of war fever. But then they would kind of be more subdued and go back to the neutrality. We don't want to get involved.
With the exception of those who were really raring to go, as we've talked
about. Right. Well, as you know, there seems to be an overnight shift once Germany announces its unrestricted submarine warfare, and you can see in Maine, and I suspect in most states in the United States, an overnight support of the war and becoming very enthusiastic to ensure that American liberties and American lives are not being threatened by the war.
1-800-399-3566. Let's go to the phones. We'll start with Jeff in Bangor. Hi, Jeff.
Hey, good afternoon. Good afternoon.
Hi. Go ahead, please.
Maine actually was in the war a lot earlier, I think, than anybody thought, simply because many of us had Canadian relatives. The troop trains were going through here, and I have a great uncle that managed to get into the fight fairly early with the Canadian Commonwealth forces and died in what is known as Third Passchendaele and was never found. So we've always had a lot of World War One lore in the family. This is, you know, an absolutely fascinating discussion, and I would encourage everybody to, if they get a chance, read Chris Clark's book about the sleepwalkers, how Europe got into World War One. You know, America was very late to this game. World War One really is a bit of an accident after literally hundreds of years of fighting in the Balkans. And if you want to look to today, the Balkans are still a trouble spot, are going to continue to be a trouble spot, and we're seeing a real growth and spread again of an ideology that says, you should be dead because I don't agree with you, and I will do everything in my power to make sure that you're dead. And that, I think, more than anything, bears a great risk for dragging us down into a war again as we continue after 17 years to fight an ideology.
Jeff? Thank you.
There's actually about 32,000 American citizens served in the Canadian military during World War One, and although it was technically not legal for that to happen, the recruiting practices, even in Maine, were quite active. And I think in Richard's book, in For the Last of the Doughboys, is a great piece on how Americans served abroad before, despite neutrality, how they many people were serving in many capacities, often in an ambulance or in medical support, but certainly joined the military of the Allied powers.
And a great many of the men who served in the Maine National Guard were first-generation Americans born to Canadian immigrant parents.
If not Canadians themselves, yeah. Because the St. John River Valley, I mean, the border at that time was not exactly what you'd call a strictly enforced crossing. It was a lot of cross-pollination of ideas and cultures, and so we had a lot of Mainers who served in the Canadian Army, and a lot of Canadians who served in the Maine National Guard, and then who enlisted in the U.S. Army as well. In fact, there's these great recruiting posters. I think the Maine Historical and Bangor Public Library have talking about it's a joint recruiting effort for the 2nd Maine Infantry, Maine National Guard, and a unit from New Brunswick jointly recruiting here in Maine. So that tells you something a little bit about the recruiting practices.
You see a lot of recruitment posters in foreign languages, depending on what the local population is, in Polish, in Italian, in Yiddish. In Greek. And Jeff brought up how, sort of what was going on in the Balkans is in essence what's going on today. And Jamie brought up earlier immigrants and are you 100% American? The war came along at the tail end of the greatest period of immigration in this country in our history. In 1880, the population of the United States was only 50 million. And between 1880 and World War I, 20 million immigrants came to this country. And as now, there was a lot of conflict and controversy and discussion over what to do with them. How do we make them American? And that was an issue that led right up to the beginning of the war and, frankly, dictated a lot of War Department policy during the war.
Let's go to Paul in Camden. Hi, Paul.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for having me on the show.
Sure. Welcome.
I just wanted to, as you can tell from my accent, I'm an immigrant as well, and I just wanted to share some of the memories and experiences that I have of my relatives being involved in the Great War. The closest relative I have who was involved was my grandmother, who drove an ambulance in Liverpool when she was only 17, which is actually before the legal age of driving. They were so desperate for ambulance drivers. She was a bit of a looker, so I think she turned some heads when she was driving people around from sites to hospitals. Also pretty close as well. My great aunt Kitty was engaged to a gentleman who never came back from the First World War, and she never married again because there was an extreme shortage of young men in England at the time because of the high amount of casualties. She remained a spinster, lived with her sister all her life. But the engagement ring and the wedding ring that they had bought to get married with actually passed down to my father, who was training to be a minister at the time in the 30s, when he just didn't have enough money to buy his own wedding ring and engagement ring. So he went to my great aunt Kitty and asked her if he could have those. And she said, of course. And he promised my mother, who was a little upset at receiving a secondhand engagement ring and wedding ring, that as soon as he had enough money, he would buy her a new one. And when he did, those passed on to myself and my wife, because, again, we didn't have enough money to buy an engagement ring and a wedding ring. And they're still here and still treasured. One of the reasons that I didn't have enough money is because I'm an actor. So.
All right, thanks.
I work for a company that is actually putting on a play opening in the April the 9th and 8th in the Rockport Opera House, which is actually written as a result of the kind of economic and national uncertainties that followed on from the end of the First World War. It's about a Jewish immigrant who fled Europe in the years following the First World War because of persecution there. And, again, met with prejudice when he got here. You know, the immigration continued from before the First World War, afterwards as well, because of the terrible economic situation in Central Europe at the time. He faced immigration when he came here, the character in the play, but nowhere near as bad as it was in Europe, where his sister, had been tortured to death and his family had been killed.
What's the name
by the German authorities?
Yeah, sorry to interrupt. What's the name of the show?
The show's called Tally's Folly.
All right.
It's being put on by the Everyman Repertory Theatre.
All right. Great, Paul. Thank you so much for the story. Paul mentioned at the top of the call that there was a lack of he mentioned the lack of ambulance drivers. And in fact, very few people could drive at the time.
That's true. And actually, one of the veterans I interviewed for the last of the Doughboys, a fellow named Howard Ramsey, was assigned to a unit called the 302nd Water Tank Train, for which he drove a truck precisely because he actually had worked as a taxi driver before the war and was one of the very few people who had a lot of experience driving automobiles.
Let's go to Peter in Waterville. Hi, Peter.
Hi. Good morning.
Morning.
Hi, Jonathan.
How you doing, Peter?
Good. Listen, a couple of things I just want to mention, as part of the talking, we mentioned about, Maynard serving in the Canadian Forces. Well, part of my history is my grandfather was a Canadian, and he was in the 1st Artillery, Canadian Artillery Brigade, and served in World War One. And my grandmother used to tell me stories about his service and stuff. But what I really wanted to mention was, this war, actually, we lost more Mainers to disease than we did to died of wounds. And the big challenge was, this was the first war that mustard gas came out. We had a lot of injuries due to mustard gas and kind of things like that were not necessarily from other wars. And so it was really kind of a different kind of war, and this really brought on machine guns and tanks and stuff really up, the losses in that kind of stuff. I mean, so but I just wanted to mention that. That's all right. All.
Peter, thank you very much. Any comment?
Thanks, Peter. It's so Peter Ogden, he used to be the head of the Maine Bureau of Veterans Services, and so he's done a lot of great stuff. I've worked with him quite a lot in the past. He brought up a really good point with as regards to the gas. You know, you talk about World War One and the discussion of mustard gas and chlorine and all these horrible things being used for the first time as sort of inescapable. And one of the things I've come across in my research where I've been studying rosters of Maine soldiers, specifically those who were in the 2nd Maine Infantry, which would later on become the 103rd U.S. Infantry as part of the Yankee Division. Studying the rosters that were put together, they list whether they were killed or wounded or anything like that. And then you go through letters and you find out that pretty much everybody was gassed. If you were on the front lines, you were gassed at some point to one degree or another. So really, when you're looking at numbers of wounded in action, that skyrockets because a lot of these, they didn't know the effects at the time. They didn't know what it would do. And what it turned out to be was if you were gassed and it went into your lungs, a lot of times that would come up about 20, 30 years down the line and be fatal, lessen your lifespan by a couple of decades. So it's really one of those things that played a significant role in the war.
All right, we're going to take another quick break. When we come back, more of your questions and comments. The number, 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Maine Health. Working with member organizations like Franklin Community Health Network so our communities are the healthiest in America. MaineHealth.org, and the law offices of Joe Bornstein, a statewide practice representing injured and disabled Mainers since 1974. JoeBornstein.com.
When a Stanford professor came up with a way to make doing your taxes painless, he thought everyone would like the plan, but lawmakers wouldn't listen, so he hired a lobbyist.
They gave me a deal because they thought it would be kind of fun to work for this crazed professor. So I paid $35,000, I believe.
I'm Ari Shapiro, one man trying to make taxes enjoyable. This afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
That's coming up this afternoon at 4 o'clock here on Maine Public Radio. And coming up in about 20 minutes in our 2 o'clock public affairs hour is City Arts and Lectures featuring Edward Snowden and Daniel Ellsberg. Again, coming up in 20 minutes here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Keith Shortall. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, Maine's involvement in the First World War. In our studio, Richard Rubin contributes regularly to The Atlantic, The New York Times, The New Yorker, and AARP Magazine. His new book, out April 4th, is Back Over There, One American Time Traveler, 100 Years Since the Great War, 500 Miles of Battle-Scarred French Countryside, Too Many Trenches, Shells, Legends, and Ghosts to Count. Jonathan Bratton, historian for the Maine National Guard, and Jamie Kingman Rice, director of library services for the Maine Historical Society. Currently on display at the Maine Historical Society is the exhibit called World War One and the Maine Experience. Join the conversation, the number 800-399-3566. Here in the final segment, I want to get into the lasting effects of World War One, how it shaped our country and who we are today. It's a big topic, Jamie Kingman Rice, but how would you assess it?
I think that there are two major themes that I would address. Obviously, the impact on Europe and the Middle East and the drawing of boundaries and the shifting in Europe. But to bring it back to the United States, World War One was America's debut onto the international stage. So one can argue that the Spanish-American War was sort of our first dance with imperialism, but really it defined – World War One defined America as a world power, as a force to be reckoned with, and we poised ourselves as the defender of democracy in that instance. So it placed us in a position that I think a lot of Americans may think that the United States has always sort of maintained that role. But World War One is largely responsible for the reputation and the position that our country is in today.
Well, World War One, as I said earlier, essentially created the United States of America in which we all live. But it was also a genuine watershed in that before that, we could always retreat across our ocean. We could be a hemispheric power without all the entanglements of being a world power. But after World War I, we were indisputably a world power, one of the top world powers. And try as we might after that to go back through that door and retreat to being just a hemispheric power, we've never been able to do it again. And I think there's a sense among a lot of people who lean toward isolationism in this country that we lost something during World War I. I had a professor in college who was very much of that mind, and he actually made an argument that had never occurred to me before, which was that we shouldn't have entered the war, and that if we hadn't, it would have ended in a stalemate, no Third Reich, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But I think what was really driving that was just his sense that we were better off before that. Now, you can disagree with that, and a great many people do, but it's indisputable that it transformed us thoroughly inside and out as a nation.
And I think sort of the legacy, you know, speaking as a main National Guard historian, the legacy for us was that the National Guard for the first time was not being used in as a U.S. volunteer force, either as a constabulary force in Cuba or the Philippines as it was in the Spanish-American War, but as a real peer competitor with the regular army. So you're taking these kids from all across Maine, putting them on transports and taking them over an entire ocean to go fight in another nation's war. You know, you're putting nationwide, you're putting several million men in uniform in about a year and a half and putting them across an ocean. No insignificant feat for a country, again, as I said, that had about 120,000 men in their army at the beginning of the war. And so what that does is it sets the stage for the U.S. military to actually be victorious in World War II. There, I would argue that the U.S. military would have been significantly unprepared for World War II if they had not taken part in World War I. Now you can say, well, would there have been a World War II? But the combat leaders of World War II, of Patton and George C. Marshall especially, and MacArthur, really, that's where they saw all the bad, you know, how to do things well and how to do things poorly were on the fields of France. So they made their first mistakes, and they learned a lot from it. And for the veteran community, when the veterans came home from World War I, no one knew what to do with these several million men. What do you do with them? And so you have the bonus march in the 1930s. And what comes out of that in World War II is the GI Bill.
Because many in World War II, they came home to no safety net whatsoever. They lost businesses. And
There was nothing for them. There was one thing, and it was optional. It was called war insurance that you could take out if you were willing to pay $10 of your monthly paycheck for it. And if you didn't take that out, you got nothing. And these men came home often maimed, missing limbs, their lungs seared, their businesses in ruins because they weren't there to tend to them. And they had to start all over again with no safety net. And it took this country a generation to figure out how to treat its veterans.
Let's go to David in Skowhegan. Hi, David. Welcome to the program.
Well, hi. Thanks for accepting my call. I'm a former history teacher, and I'm very, very interested in World War I history, not only how it impacted this great country, but our state of Maine, and in particular, my hometown of Skowhegan. During World War I, Skowhegan gave up 17 boys in that war, and over 500 of our native sons from town served in World War I. Today, we've named our American Legion post after the last boy of the 17 killed, and our VFW hall was named Joseph R. Sanford, who was the first boy killed. In fact, Sanford was out of Bowdoin College at the time, and he joined the British Royal Flying Corps, and he was shot down by a German aviator in April of 1918, and Skowhegan's sacrifice began at that point.
Yes.
So that interests me to no end. Another point of the 17 boys who were killed, one of whom was a boy named St. Ledger, Michael St. Ledger, nicknamed Mickey, and he was a dear friend of a gal named Margaret Chase. And, of course, Margaret Chase later became Senator Margaret Chase Smith, who served more than 30 years in the United States Congress. St. Ledger was killed in July 18th, 1918, at the Battle of Chateau Thierry, which I suppose technically it was the Battle of the Aisne-Marne, but I suppose Chateau Thierry had a more exotic name, and it was applied to that battle where the St. Ledger boy was killed.
Yeah.
So that helped focus Margaret's interests on the Naval Affairs Committee when she was in the House of Representatives, and later on the Senate Armed Services Committee.
Right, so that actually had a personal effect on an
important. It did.
Important
she program. Actually also served as a Red Cross volunteer during World War One, and the Skowhegan History House has a, the Margaret Chase Smith Library have a great photo of her in her uniform.
And this points up what you said at the top, Richard, which is that towns did in fact take steps to remember and honor these folks. It was a big. It was important historically to them.
Oh, almost universally. I don't think the significance of what they had given and what they had lost was lost on them at all. And in fact, you go to small towns outside Farmington. There's this wonderful arch standing in the middle of a little triangle, and there's actually a sign just pointing to it. Farmington, a small town, has this very large World War I memorial. Mm-hmm. You can tell that town really felt the sacrifice of that war.
Let's go to David in Waterford. Hi, David.
Hi. Yes, I just wanted to call your attention to something which covered calls, which is home front, really. An article from 1917, which I have emailed to you separately from Everybody's Magazine, which is called Norway America. And it is about the extraordinary lengths to which the citizens of Norway, Maine, went to support World War One. They developed a program to help farmers grow crops. They had people out at 6 a.m. picking up volunteers. They were growing pigs. They developed Red Cross volunteers. They set records in the bond drives, $100,000 to $150,000 from a town of 3,000. And it was led by local businessmen and some of what might be called the intellectuals, including a man named Talbot Mundy, who was a British writer of adventure stories, who became an American citizen at the beginning of the war, and who developed a number of these initiatives. Yeah. Quite remarkable.
All right, David, thank you. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. I'm wondering if the parallels that we've been talking about in terms of the forces of nationalism, of fears of the globalization and its positive effects on some, negative effects on others, and those forces, do you think it will reinvigorate interest in World War One? What is it going to take for us to, I guess, rediscover and acknowledge the importance of World War One in a way that we have not done that yet?
I think one leading piece of that would be the World War One Memorial in Washington, D.C., which is amazing that there isn't one, and that it's now on the centennial that the funds are being raised. So encourage people to support that. But to draw attention, you know, I'm not sure that there's really anything one can do to bring World War One to the forefront, sort of beyond World War Two. You know, in many ways, history decides itself. But I think that honoring the service and recognizing the pitfalls and communicating about where the world, where Europe, where the United States was in 1914, 1917, and a reminder that we've been down a lot of these roads before is really the best that we can do. So preserving that memory, honoring the service and sacrifice of the individuals who participated at home and abroad, and then learning from our mistakes. But that's sort of cliche in many ways, you know, to learn from history. But think for the three of us, that's sort of why we do what we do.
And yeah. I think one of the key points is what David, the caller from Skowhegan, brought up, talking about, you know, Skowhegan made there were 17 boys from Skowhegan who made the ultimate sacrifice. That is a comment that could ring from across all the towns in Maine. All the small towns and cities each have that list. And I know for Skowhegan especially, I'm glad he brought it up because there was St. Ledger, the young man he mentioned, was part of the Skowhegan High School squad. It was a squad of young men who were supposed to graduate in 1917 and sped up their graduation so that they could go overseas with Company E, 103rd Infantry. And the majority of them were killed or wounded on that day, July 18th. That right there is it's indicative of many stories across Maine, and it's the thing that people connect to because people connect to human stories that really bring about an emotion within you. And so I think that's how we get people to connect to World War I, is bring it back to that human connection.
I think also, just very quickly, you know, I spoke earlier about it made us into the world power we are today, which is true, but it also changed us from inside out too. You know, everything that you can – food rationing, first done in the First World War. Rosie the Riveter was a creature of the First World War, not the Second World War. In 1913, America was a majority rural nation. After the war, it was a majority urban nation. It forged the very nature and character of this country inside as well. And I think that people, if they make the connections themselves, they'll be drawn to it more.
And we'll stay with you because I know there are a few events coming up that we want to let people know about that you're taking part in. Why don't you?
Well, I'll be speaking at the Maine Historical Society on April 20th at 7 p.m. Very much looking forward to that. And it's going to be a very Maine-specific talk. And I'm also – there's a documentary coming up on PBS on April 10th, 11th, and 12th called The Great War. It's a three-part, six-hour documentary. And I'm featured in that as well.
Yeah, and the Guard has?
Yeah, well, we've got a number of things going on. One thing I would ask people to do if you're interested in Maine and World War I, check out our Facebook page, Maine World War I Centennial Commemoration. We've got a bunch of our events, including Richard's, highlighted on there, as well as a lot of events that are happening all over the state for this centennial. There are organizations such as the Osher Map Library has an exhibit opening up just in a few days. And then I would really invite people to join us on April 6th, the centennial of the Declaration of War, 1 o'clock p.m. at the State Cultural Building where the museum and the archives and library are up in Augusta. We'll be holding an event to commemorate the beginning of World War I and Maine's entrance into that. So we'd really enjoy seeing you all there.
And we'll post all this a few seconds, though, with
yes.
the exhibition.
On April 5th, we have another speaker at the Maine Historical Society, Donald Zellman from the University of Maine Law School. And then, of course, the World War I and Maine Experience, which is on view at our Portland location until June 4th. And then lastly, the Maine Memory Network, where we share our online World War I collections.
All right. Excellent. Thank you all three for being here today. Appreciate it. Jamie Kingman Rice, Director of Library Services for the Maine Historical Society. Jonathan Bratton, historian for the Maine National Guard. And Richard Rubin, the author of The Last of the Doughboys and his new book out April 4th, Back Over There. Jonathan Woodward ran the board today. You can find past editions of Maine Calling, a link as well as a link to our audio archives by visiting mainecalling.net. I'm Keith Shortall. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.